Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva at the UN. Today is Friday, 14th of February. Sorry for being a little bit late. I would like to start the briefing by welcoming the students of the Webster Universities, led by your former colleague, Lionel Faton, now Professor Lionel Faton. And I would also like to start this briefing by congratulating the new committee of the Association of Accredited Journalists to the UN, ACANU. We have, this week had the election of the new members. I'd like to congratulate them all and thank the members of the committee that was in charge last year for the good cooperation that we will shortly continue with the new elected colleagues. So let's start immediately by going to our first speaker, Eugene from UNHCR. I think, Eugene, you have an update on DRC. I'll give you the floor.
Thank you, Alexandra. Hello, everyone. I'm happy to brief about a DRC update, one of the worst humanitarian crisis unfolding. And also happy to have the Webster student. So UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, is alarmed by the rapidly worsening humanitarian crisis in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, as the continued lack of access to displaced people hampers the provision of an urgently needed aid. Heavy artillery shelling and looting have destroyed 70,000 emergency shelters around Goma and Minova in North and South Kivu provinces, leaving some 350,000 internally displaced people once again without a roof over their heads. Hundreds of thousands of displaced people are now living in overcrowded makeshift shelters, churches, and hospitals. The displaced people in Goma are also affected by the considerable increase in crime. While some 100,000 internally displaced people have attempted to return to their home, warehouses have been damaged, and there are little or no essential services. Many remain stranded in collective centers, damaged IDP sites, or with the host community. Displaced people reported that the fear of unexploded ordnance, destroyed homes, and lack of essential services are significant obstacles to their safe return. The crisis is worsening as people flee to areas where humanitarian aid cannot reach due to insecurity. In South Kivu, over 50% of humanitarian organizations providing critical support to survivors of sexual violence report being unable to reach those in need due to insecurity and continuous displacement. Meanwhile, in North Kivu, the destruction of a health facility, including a mortuary and overcrowded hospitals, increased the risk of spreading infectious disease, including cholera, malaria, and measles. UNHCR team in both North and South Kivu continue to assist displaced people as much as possible. They have seen a family once again packing up their few remaining belongings, trapped in uncertainty, unable to stay yet with no safe place to go. Among them is a 55-year-old widow with 5 children who lost everything when she fled her village to seek safety in Goma. Now, she has been forced to leave the Blengo IDP site on the outskirts of the city with no idea of where she will go. Residents of Bukavu, home to 1.3 million people, are on high alert as insecurity worsens in the region, prompting many to flee further south and beyond. A further influx of people into the city is expected in the coming days, potentially followed by onward movement as the fighting spreads. UNHCR remain committed to supporting civilians in North and South Kivu and is closely monitoring the situation. UNHCR stands ready to help community recover by providing shelter and relief items for vulnerable households. However, without sufficient financial resource, the ability to provide life-saving assistance such as shelter, healthcare, and protection services will be severely limited, further deepening the suffering of vulnerable populations. UNHCR urges the international community to bolster their support to prevent a deeper humanitarian catastrophe. UNHCR once again calls for an immediate cessation of hostility to ensure the safety of a civilian, including displaced populations, and to uphold international humanitarian principles, including the right to move freely in search of safety. We urge all parties to stop attacks on civilian infrastructure and guarantee unhindered humanitarian access. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Eugene. And just to complete the information about DRC, I'd like to draw your attention to the statement by UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell that was issued yesterday on the situation of children in Eastern DRC, who are increasingly exposed to sexual violence, abduction, and and recruitment, and also to the information that was given yesterday by our colleagues at the World Food Programme about the incredible problems that disruptions in market prices in and around Goma, the prices have grown exponentially and nutrition remains inaccessible for many. The World Food Programme's operation in this area remain paused, but the agency is ready to resume operation as soon as it's safe to do so. So I'll now open the floor to question on the DRCs. Robin?
Thank you, good morning. What are some of the dangers of having such a large number of people on the move within a conflict zone? And of the people that you have been able to reach, how many are there and what sort of condition are those people in? And also, what supplies do you have pre-positioned within the area that you might be able to get into that area once conditions allow?
Thank you, Robin, for your question. The lack of essential service of those the displaced person who are already displaced multiple times is the biggest concern, as well as I mentioned that the IDP sites which are destroyed, so meaning that those people doesn't have a shelter. So many are just stranded on the street and then living on the street. And then also that a lot of essential infrastructure are destroyed inside of IDP sites, which is the toilet, the health facility. So, and then also the lack of clean water is increasing the significantly the risk of the disease among them. So as Alexandra mentioned, that there is an increased risk of GBV, we have heard about this risk over and over. And then we are calling the all party involved and also everyone to uphold the humanitarian, international humanitarian law to protect and then prevent the GBV in DRC. So there is a place that we are still unable to reach, but there is a place around the Goma, there has been 28 IDP sites. Most of them are destroyed. Still, we have some of the access, but our most biggest concern is that we don't have the access from Goma. The road from the Goma to Bukavu is cut. So also that causes a lot of anxious around humanitarians. And also that talking about the supplies that, of course, our warehouse were also looted and impacted, but there is a warehouse that we haven't been looted, and which hasn't been looted. So, which means that we still have some supplies, and then we are coordinated with other agency who also have some supplies on the ground, for example, shelter material. So we are gathering those information that which agency has what to in order to deliver those supplies to those area that we still have access.
Thank you very much. Yes, please.
Hi, thank you very much for this briefing. It's Olivia Lepodova from Reuters.
Oh, that's right. She doesn't know you yet.
thank you. Hi, thank you very much. I wanted to follow up. Could you kindly just confirm again how many IDP sites have been destroyed? And just to check, do you know by whom and where exactly are those sites? And just secondly, as well, just confirming it's 350,000 IDPs without a roof over their head? Just want to check that figure. Thank you.
So I mentioned that around the Goma there is a 28 IDP site. What I heard is 70% of them are destroyed, and also that we are hearing the report that in South Kivu, the Minova IDP sites around the Minova has also been destroyed. So 350,000 people without roof at the moment. Among them, as I mentioned, the 100,000 are attempt to return to their hometown, which they also found difficulty because of explosive ordinance and also lack of services. So meaning that if they cannot find a safety and an essential service of place of origin, there is also a possibility of those people will be displaced once again.
Thank you, Jean. Other question in the room? No, I don't see. So Yuri, online.
Yes, thank you, Jean. Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning. My question is regarding the last week when we had a special session on the Human Rights Council on the situation in DRC. Did you see any improvement in the situation there in DRC after this session regarding to access or regarding to the conditions for the displaced people? Thank you.
Thank you, Yuri. As I highlight, I think what we are seeing on the ground is a worsening condition. And we're also hearing that a lot of people around and in Bukavu, in South Kivu, is also fearing the further violence, which will eventually make them decide to move to further to south or in neighboring country.
Thank you. Any other question? Yes, Robin.
Hello. Just to ask if you have had any contact at all with any of the warring parties, or perhaps those countries that might have influence over them, to find out more information about the situation on the ground and to relay to them directly your concerns.
We are currently not having particular the contact with the warring parties, but we are still on the ground to support the humanitarian perspective and aspect of this crisis. So, to answer your question, no, but we are continue to call for those two warring parties to respect and protect the civilian and the civilian infrastructure.
As we do, and maybe this gives me the opportunity to remind you that the Secretary General is currently in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia to take part in the 38th African Union Summit, and he is scheduled to take part in meetings of the African Union Peace and Security Council at the level of heads of states and government, where they will have a specific meeting on the situation in Eastern DRC. So that will be at the highest level by the Secretary General. And in fact, this gives me also the opportunity to inform you that in addition to the remarks that he will deliver to the opening session on Saturday, he is scheduled to hold a press conference around 3 p.m. at this time. And you can, of course, follow it on UN Web TV. Antonio. Have to unmute yourself. Yeah, you are?
Okay. Yes, I am unmuted now. So it's a question of a more general problem. Maybe you don't have the numbers now, but the US has suspended the programs for resettling refugees in the country. And I would like to know how many refugees are affected by this, from which countries. I know this week in Spain there was a call from a UNHCR official for other countries to accept the refugees that the US is not accepting now. So did some countries answer to this call? So if you can give us some information on this later in the day, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
So to just simply answer, Antonio, and then maybe we can follow up. But yes, we are aware that the resettlement program is impacted, but how many are impacted is still uncertain. And then that's something that we can follow up with you separately.
Thank you very much. Any other question to UNHCR? Yes, Mohammed.
Thank you so much, Mohammed from Turkey's Anadolu News Agency. I would like to ask you about Goma Airport. The airport still is closed, and is there opportunity to use this airport for humanitarian operations? Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. As far as I know, that the airport is still not functioning for the humanitarian aid, and this is one of our concern as well. And then at the same time, that since the violence has spread to the South Kivu, and then those supply pipeline is our biggest concern. And as soon as we have opportunity to reach and have access to those people in need, we will definitely need the road, and then air has to be open and then accessible for the humanitarian agency to bring their the additional supplies.
Indeed. Any other question? I don't see any. So thank you very much, Eugene, for this briefing. And I'd like now to go to my left, to Tommaso Della Longa. Tommaso, you have brought us Madeleine Lyons, who is the IFRC Senior Humanitarian Analyst. She is calling in from Ottawa to tell us about the 3 years of the conflict in Ukraine. Indeed, almost 3 years, as you know, have passed since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, and 11 years since the annexation of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea and city of Sebastopol, and the war continues to inflict untold suffering on the Ukrainian people and has profound global implications, as we've heard these last days. The war must end now in line with the UN Charter, international law, and UN resolutions, and IFRC has more on that. Tommaso.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, as you said, today we want to present this new report ahead of this sad 3 years mark of the Russia-Ukraine international conflict. The headline of the report is "At a Tipping Point: How Financial Strains Are Driving Ukrainians Abroad Back Home." And again, just two things to highlight. The first one is that the report is now online, so you can find the full report on our website. And second, let me thank Madeleine, because it's very early in the morning and she's up here to present the report.
Yeah, that's very kind of you. Thank you very much. You have the floor.
Thank you very much for having me. Many displaced Ukrainians are reaching a tipping point where the struggle to remain abroad has become unsustainable, and returning to Ukraine means living in uncertainty. Our latest data is showing that economic strains and declining international support are driving many Ukrainians into significant hardship, both inside and outside the country. The data is gathered through our partnership with Impact Initiatives and is substantiated by data through several national societies, including the Ukraine Red Cross Society. We're seeing that more than one in four people are settling in areas near the front lines once they return, where security remains a critical concern. They're returning for several reasons. A large percentage of people are driven to return by a desire to reunite with family. More than half are returning due to economic reasons. However, what was unexpected in this report is that there was a growing number of people who are indicating that they are driven to return due to financial exhaustion and limited access to essential services in host countries. This includes, say, 13% of refugees who cite medical care as their reason for returning. 10% are citing education as their primary driver of return. And once they return, we see that 23% are being forced to reduce their food intake due to a lack of resources. For those on the front line, their challenges are immense. We see 65% of returnees returning to homes that are damaged or uninhabitable, leaving them to rebuild in the middle of a conflict zone. Their daily life is being shaped by air raid sirens and infrastructure that has been damaged by the ongoing conflict. A shocking 79% of returnees report urgent unmet humanitarian needs, ranging from food and necessities to assistance finding employment. Still, many of those on the front line are contributing to Ukraine's rebuilding efforts, despite these extraordinary challenges. The lack of medical resources, compounded by the ongoing conflict and infrastructure damage, leaves returnees particularly vulnerable to long-term health consequences. This is exacerbated by challenges resuming their previous employment. While returning presents severe risks, the situation for Ukrainians living abroad also remains deeply challenging. We see that savings have dried up, and many have resorted to taking on new debt to get by. We can see that in countries like Romania, families who once had enough savings to sustain themselves are now struggling to afford groceries, rent, and healthcare. In Moldova, 36% of those displaced are now relying on humanitarian aid as their primary source of income. Older people are among the most vulnerable. Many have lost not only their homes, but also the social connections and support networks that once sustained them. Only 27% of elderly Ukrainians living abroad live in private housing, leaving most in temporary shelters or dependent on assistance that is stretched to its limits. For those with chronic illnesses, the inability to access medical care is more than just an inconvenience. It can be life-threatening. We see that 18% of displaced older Ukrainians cited urgent unmet medical needs as one of their key humanitarian requirements. Without proper medication, we know blood pressure rises, diabetes goes unmanaged, and minor infections turn into serious complications. Some have no choice but to navigate foreign healthcare systems in languages they don't understand, hoping that someone will take the time to help them. For many displaced Ukrainians, the longer they remain abroad, the harder it is to find a path forward. Language barriers shut them out of job opportunities, and without financial independence, many feel trapped in a cycle of uncertainty. 63% of Ukrainians abroad are in entry-level jobs, up from just 23% who worked in those positions prior to the escalation, where the majority were employed in professional or managerial positions. This, of course, has had a dramatic effect on their quality of life and the future for those households. In the face of this crisis, the IFRC and our network of 60 Red Cross and Red Crescent societies continue to deliver one of the largest humanitarian responses in our history. Across Ukraine and in host countries, we are providing life-saving assistance to those in need. In Ukraine, our teams are delivering emergency cash assistance to prevent vulnerable families from falling further into debt. We're providing food, shelter, and medical care. And as the winter sets in, our volunteers are distributing hygiene kits, blankets, and setting up heating stations to keep people warm. Our largest ever mental health initiative is helping those struggle with the psychological toll of the conflict through counseling, stress relief workshops, and psychological first aid. From language classes to vocational training to legal aid and social integration programs, we're working to ensure that displaced individuals have the tools they need to rebuild their lives. But even with all these efforts, we see the uncertainty in the future. The needs remain significant and the resources to meet them shrinking. At the same time, policies are changing in host countries, often reducing assistance or narrowing eligibility for displaced Ukrainians who are still struggling to survive. Now is the moment for governments, donors, and the international community to reaffirm their commitment to these communities and to people who desperately need this support. Without sustained assistance, more people will face impossible choices, cutting back on meals, delaying medical care, or returning to unsafe conditions simply because they have nowhere else to go. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I would like to remind everybody of the numbers that we have seen from the protection of civilians. Those who are in the country, those who really come back, are really the first priority that we have to have. In January 2025, civilian casualties increased 39% compared in January, to compare to December, and 27% compared to January of last year. So this is really the biggest worry we have. And since we are speaking also about funds, I just would like to remind you that, as you know, $2.63 billion are needed by the UN and partners to assist 6 million people through the humanitarian needs and response plan. And as of the 13th of February, only 12% the appeal is funded to a level of 12%. So I think important to recall. So I'll open the floor to questions now on Ukraine. Robin, for Madeleine. Robin is our correspondent of the AFP.
Thank you. Two questions. Those people who are returning to dangerous areas near the front line, what does that tell you about the situations that they are returning from, if that is a preferable option for their lives? And secondly, on this issue of a personal debt, how large is this becoming for the refugee and returnee community, and what are some of the possible pathways that people might be able to get out of that situation?
Madeleine, we answer every question in a press conference style. So if you want to go ahead.
Thank you so much. Robin, very, very interesting questions. I think the first piece around why the population are returning, there's two factors here. So firstly, we see that people want to return back to a place that is familiar to them. We see the power of home, you know, the desire to return back, as you can imagine, and we can all empathize with, the desire to be somewhere that is familiar in such uncertain and unfamiliar times. So that's part of the equation that we're seeing. I think the other piece, however, is recognizing that we remain concerned that there are governments that are interpreting the Temporary Protection Directive across Europe in a more and more restricted way. And we do see that this is contributing to hardship as the number of people who are, for example, eligible for accommodation assistance. We see that these individuals are particularly challenged then to make ends meet. And we do see this sort of consequence or carry-on effect around household debt. So moving on to that second question, one of the statistics I would point you towards is that we know, we see in our post-distribution monitoring that around 30% of households across the European region, on average, have taken on new household debt. However, I'd point you to particularly severe debt acquisition levels in households in Romania and Moldova. In Romania, 15% of households have taken on not just new debt, but debt that is unrepayable or debt that we would consider to be at unsustainable or unmanageable levels. I think the important point is that regardless of the country, what's very interesting in this data is that we see the reason for acquiring this new debt is by and large, firstly, that people are borrowing to buy food and other expendables, you know, clothing, things that are fundamental. Secondly, we see that they're using it to pay for accommodation. And thirdly, we see that, upsettingly, they're using it to pay for healthcare services. So those are the three main drivers of this new debt acquisition. In terms of how they get out of the cycle, we and our humanitarian partners have been endeavoring to support them through cash transfer programs and other forms of assistance. However, I think recognizing that for many of these households, they are still effectively in the relief phase of this experience, and that there is a long journey remaining ahead of them, necessitates additional humanitarian support as well as additional support from our government partners.
Thank you very much. It's another, Christian Ulrich, German News Agency.
Yes, thank you for the briefing. Since we didn't have a chance to look at the report yet and I couldn't find it in the last 5 minutes, can you give us an idea of how many people you interviewed? In how many countries and when these interviews took place, referring to all the percentages that you gave us. Thank you.
Perfect. Brilliant question. So the number of people who were surveyed for this, we did this survey in partnership with Impact Initiatives. The survey for refugees spans 6 different country contexts, including Germany. And the numbers were about 3,200 households that were surveyed by phone in Ukrainian for this. The survey took place at the end of, up until the end of October, beginning of November. In terms of the returnee data that I've cited, the population that was surveyed is about 2,200, and that data collection took place shortly after that timeline.
Yes, Olivia, Reuters.
Thank you.
you were describing how you've been providing life-saving assistance. How concerned are you by current aid freezes by the US, and how might this impact your operations on the ground, both now, imminently, but also looking forward to the rest of this year?
Tommaso, you might have more information on this than I do.
Yeah, thank you, Madeleine, and thank you for the question. Of course, every budget cut is concerning. When it's coming to the Ukrainian appeal, and what we are saying today is basically that we have been seeing an overall and ongoing trend which began last year. So just to give you an example, in 2024, our emergency appeal received a contribution of 30 million Swiss francs compared to 108 million in 2023. So reduction of 78 million between 2023 and 2024. So, of course, I think that it's a wide concern when we're talking about humanitarian budget cuts.
Thank you very much. I'll go to the platform. Satoko Adachi, Yomiuri Shimbun.
Hello. Thank you very much for Alessandra. And thank you very much for doing this. You talked about returnees returning to homes. And could you give us some demographic picture here? Are these returnees going back more to Western Ukraine or across the country, including Eastern Ukraine? Thank you.
Thank you very much for the question. We do see that 27% of returnees are returning to frontline areas. So there is a surprising number of people who are returning back to their pre-conflict settlement or pre-escalation settlement. Of that number, we see that the demographics do tilt slightly to women without children. We know that elderly people were more likely to remain in those settlements and not to originally be displaced. So we do see that that population remains overrepresented in the number of people who are continuing to reside in these communities. However, yes, it's generally women without children who are now returning. Again, the primary driver of return that we're seeing is family reunification, including with elderly parents and spouses. But the second driver, aside from employment, that we're beginning to see increasingly drivers suggesting that it's not so much the pull factors, but a growing number of push factors making life in Europe increasingly financially difficult. So, for example, we see 9% of returnees to their frontline areas saying they're returning because of financial, that life in Europe is financially unfeasible for them.
Thanks, Madeleine. I see Satoko has a follow-up. You have to unmute yourself, Satoko.
Hello,
can you hear me? We can hear you. Yeah, sure.
Does that mean that they are also going back to the occupied territory by Russia in Ukraine?
I unfortunately don't have data about those territories for today's presentation. What I can say is the number of people who are moving back to those frontline areas was a surprise to us. We didn't anticipate to see roughly over one in four returning to those frontline areas. We're very aware that this puts them at additional risk of other levels of humanitarian vulnerability, and we're concerned about their well-being. We know that 30% of them are uncertain about their intention to remain over the next 3 months. So we do see that there is the risk of further displacement. Having returned back to these frontline areas, they may now in turn be re-displaced from those frontline areas. So they're living in a precarious state. And we also know that living in this kind of uncertainty has a huge mental toll on the population. So we're very aware of the demand for psychosocial services that exists in the country.
Thank you very much. Yuri Prelefrio Novosti.
Yes, thank you. And it was almost the same question than Satoko.
Tu as disparu, Yuri. On ne t'entend plus. Yuri. On a un problème avec les sons. On ne t'entend plus. Tu veux reconnecter?
Est-ce que vous m'entendez?
Ah, voilà, tu es revenu. Vas-y.
Okay, thank you. I'm quite surprised with the answer because I had the same question that Satoko just asked. If your data also include Ukrainians who are returning to Russian-controlled cities and areas once the fighting is over via Belarus and Russia, because, for example, I took the bus between Poland and Belarus, and it was full of Ukrainians coming back to these territories through Belarus and through Russia after that to come back to the Donbas area. And as you say that you have no data on that, but the Red Cross has also a federation in Belarus, also a federation in Russia, and you are working with them. So I'm quite surprised why these people are not at all in your data. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. At this point, our data is limited in terms of it does not include the occupied territories or the territories no longer under the control of the Ukrainian government. It also does not include populations that have returned to the Russian Federation. That said, we're working closely with the Russian Red Cross to understand the needs of these populations and endeavoring to improve our data reach for these populations in the future as well. So, Tommaso, did you have any additional insight on this or any additional comment that you wanted to add?
Yeah, no, thanks, Madeleine. Thanks, Yuri, for the question. I mean, it's a very good point. Just to say that we are updating these figures, and correct me if I'm wrong, Madeleine, I think every 3 or 4 months. And of course, there is always the will to update all these kind of studies, also related to the people in different areas of the country, also in the areas held by the Russian armed forces. So we'll see in the next future which kind of update we can provide. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up in the room or on the platform. So thank you very much to our colleague of IFRC. And Madeleine, thanks for being up this time of the day as early as 4 o'clock in the morning, I understand. Thank you for briefing us and come back anytime. Thank you, Tommaso. So I only have a couple of announcements for you. One is on behalf of Pascal of the Human Rights Council. He would like to inform you that the UN Human Rights Council Advisory Committee will hold its 33rd session from the 17th to the 21st of February in room 20. It's an open session. It's open to the media, but it will not be webcast live. In case you want to hear, you have to go in person there. More details on the issues to be discussed at these sessions are going to be in the, where? In the media advisory, which was shared with you yesterday afternoon. Also on the human rights committees, the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women is reviewing today the report of Liechtenstein. And in the afternoon on Monday, next Monday, they will hold a half day of general discussion on gender stereotypes. The Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights is concluding this morning the review of the UK. The next countries under scrutiny are Rwanda, the Philippines and Kenya. And that is what I had on the announcement side for the human rights. Do you have any question? Yes, Olivia.
Thank you. I just have a question for Christian Lindmeier from World Health Organization.
Yeah, he should be online, huh? Christian, show your face. I think you are there, if I'm not wrong. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Christian. I have two questions on two different subjects. The first is about Mpox, the first case being reported in the UAE yesterday. Please, would you tell us some more details on that, if you have any? And the second is your organization has issued a report essentially suggesting that alcohol labels should raise awareness that consuming alcohol can lead to cancer. I just would like to understand from WHO, how does this call for labels to differ from your previous position? And also, are you able to clarify whether it supports warning labels on alcoholic drinks globally or just in Europe? So yeah, any details on that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Christian.
Yeah, thank you very much. I have very limited. So on the last one, we really have to get back to you because that's very detailed on a subject I don't have with me. I also don't have many more details on the mpox cases now reported, other than countries that newly reported cases of the clade 1 B include the UAE, as you mentioned, Thailand and China, but not much more I can share with you right now. Nope, sorry for that.
Thanks, Christian. There are more hands up. I don't know if they're for you. Let's start with Antonio.
It's for you, Alessandra. I want to know if the president of the Human Rights Council is organizing a press conference next week.
Well, I know that this is a tradition, so I believe that would be the case, but I cannot speak for the council. We have to ask Pascal, and I'll ask him to come back to all of you with this information. It's pretty traditional. They always do, so I hope that would be the case this year, too. Thank you. Catherine Fiancan is the new president of ACANO. I'd like to congratulate her for the election. Catherine, you have the floor.
Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you. Looking forward to continue to work with Eunice, and congratulations to the former president, Yuri Aprelev, who did an incredible job.
And with whom we had a great cooperation. Thank you very much, Catherine. Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to come back to mpox. A question has been asked, and I'd like, good morning, Christian, about mpox in DR Congo. Because when ACANU received ministers from the DR Congo, they spoke about cases of mpox in Kivu. I'd like to have some details about how you are cooperating with the government on that issue. Are you able to be in the region, as the region is now with different troops controlled by foreign troops? And another question, Christian, would it be possible to have a briefing on the danger of the extra use, the too much use of video games? As recently we had yesterday the attempt in Munich, and several media spoke about the fact that the aggressivity of the killer was linked to too much use of video games and devices. So could you maybe organize something or give us the contact details of the experts at WHO on that matter? Thank you so much.
Yeah, that would help any mother in the room too, Christian. Go ahead.
And the fathers, by the way. Thank you very much, Catherine, and congrats to the new board and to you, to the new role, to the new function. On the last topic, the video game. So if there's this general interest, then we can see to organize a specific briefing. I think we had discussed this a while ago, and I think even a while ago had mentioned that, not specifically on video games, but I kind of recall something. Anyway, point being, if there's a general wish, yes, please, then we can do that. Otherwise, if it remains an individual request, happy to put you in touch indeed. So thank you for that. On your second part, what we have right now, the cases and the deaths in the DRC on mpox so far, we have 1,348 lab confirmed cases, but zero deaths so far, as that's of 2 February. So that's already, 12 days old confirmed data. Even in 2024, the case fatality rate for mpox in the DRC, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, was under 0.5% among the confirmed cases, but over 2.5 in the suspected cases. That's last year's data. So now a bit about the response you targeted. So the mpox response is heavily impacted, of course, particularly in Goma and the adjacent area, and with the conflict now reaching South Kivu as well. DRC in general is the worst affected country for mpox, with Kivu being the epicenter of the clade 1B outbreak. So out of 143 confirmed mpox patients in isolation units in Goma and around, 128 fled in fear for their lives. only 15 mpox patients, about 10%, remained in isolation. And that's, of course, dangerous for everybody around for new infections, looking at the danger for the patients in the situation under attack, of course. Some health facilities are closed, others looted. Some health workers have also fled in search for security. People are unable to access healthcare due to the violence. So a very grim picture. Let's leave it at that for now. Thanks.
Thank you. I see other hands, but just to answer one of your former questions, I think Antonio asked, Matt is confirming in the chat that the president of the Human Rights Council will hold a press conference at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, 19th of February. Not sure it was announced yet, but he is confirming it in the chat. So for those who are in the room who cannot read the chat, that's the answer. Okay, so let me continue with Maya. Maya Plants.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my question. Nice to see you, Christian. I second Catherine. I would like to see if we can have a special briefing on the question of violence and video games, if possible, within the next week. And another one is also seconding my question from a colleague from AFP, Olivia. Regarding these alcohol issues, if we could have a special expert come to speak, give us a briefing on all the issues and how the WHO is involved and who are the lobbyists pushing for this kind of legislation or trying to get this kind of issues passed. So
can you clarify your last point, please, Maya? I'm not quite sure what you're asking.
Yes, to have an expert that is at the WHO that is responsible for dealing with the lobbyists that are trying to push all these frameworks regarding alcohol use, alcohol consumption.
Okay. So I take that as, in general, a request for something on alcohol consumption and the other one on video games. Okay. Yeah, thank you.
It's working. Oh, okay, sorry. Mr. Liang, China Economic Daily.
Thank you, Alexandra. My question goes to the WHO. It is about the remote possibility or lack of it about the US returning. Last month, 3 days after announcing the withdrawal from the WHO, Donald Trump said, and I quote, maybe we would consider doing it again. I don't know, maybe we would. They would have to clean it up. So my question is, after this kind of ultimatum giving to the WHO saying clean it up and then I could possibly rejoin, is it a thin end of the wedge, opening up a dangerous trend of a sovereign country blackmailing an international organization? After this announcement, during these past 3 weeks, is there any communication channels taking place about which part of the house that he wants the WHO to clean up? Thanks. Or did he just unhappily walk away? Thanks.
Very interesting you put the question. Thank you very much. There's not much I can add to that. Let me take that first part of your question. Is the announcement to possibly be interested or willing to work together again as it was put? That's a welcome statement. And as we have said all the while along, and you heard the Director General just now on Wednesday talk about this, we're open for all suggestions. After all, the US is one member state out of 194 member states, and WHO is a member state-based organization, meaning whatever the member states bring to the table needs to be discussed and has to be discussed. And we, as the Secretariat here in Geneva, are fulfilling or implementing the mandate or fulfilling the wishes, so to say, of the international states community. So, and the US is part of it. So if there's anything to be discussed, we're happy to discuss. The Director General also pointed out all the reforms undertaken and the steps undertaken. So I think we're on a good path. But again, as it was said, happy to discuss further whatever helps the situation, because after all, the global health is something which interests us all. All 194 member states and even the ones who are not members. So it's global health. All are interested. Any reductions in help and aid across the world, as we see already, is hurting. And it's hurting not only the poorest of the poor, it's hurting, it will impact people in the US as well. So there's nobody safe from this. Hence, cooperation is certainly something we should all achieve. Thank you.
John? John, you're on. We can't hear you. I see your mic is on, but I can't hear you, sorry. You want to try again? No, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, John. We don't hear you here. So either you reconnect maybe or send your question in writing in the chat. Try again. You're on again. No, I think you have a problem with your audio. Sorry for that, John. Is there any other question? Maybe John can write his one in the chat in the meantime. No, I don't see any. So, John, I'm very sorry, but I think we'll close here. And maybe you want to send your question in writing to Christian directly, because we cannot hear you. So thank you very much, Christian, for answering the questions. I think this concludes our briefing of today. So I wish you, thank you very much for being with us. I wish you a very good weekend, and I'll see you next week. Thank you.